Quick spoiler alert. I'm going to give away one of the key takeaways from this episode now. As you'll hear, surprise, Spyro Circa is a thing in Australia, depending on where you are. I feel like we're in a bit of a habit on here talking about weird parasites that have made their way from my country of birth to Australia. I just want to be clear that there is no link between my migration to Australia and the appearance of these exotic new diseases. Just in case any rumors start appearing that I'm importing stuff just so I can get exciting new content for the podcast. It's not a bad idea, actually. Anyway, so in this episode, we'll cover what the heck Spyro Circa is, what it does, how we'll spot it, and what to do about it. And one of the things that you'll learn that we'll put right here at the front end is that it can be effectively prevented with something that you probably already have on your shelves. Advocate. Our old faithful Advocate is the only registered product for preventing Spyro Circa loopy. And the team at Elanco Australia, the makers of Advocate, Credelio Plus, Serestro, Milbimax, Neptra and Galliprant, to name a few, are paying me for underlining that fact. So consider that the sponsor slot done for this episode. And thank you, Elanco, for your support. You can learn more about their range on their website at elanco.com.au. Okay, now let's get to everything you need to know about this weird, very interesting, and a little bit scary condition, Spyro Circa loopy, with Professor Peter Irwin and Dr. Gillian Tenney. Prof. Peter Irwin is an emeritus professor at Murdoch University with a career spanning nearly 40 years, working in many fields of veterinary science, including teaching many of you at uni. He's a registered specialist in canine medicine with a particular passion and extensive knowledge on anything and everything vector-borne. Basically, if you want to know anything about any disease that spends some part of its life cycle inside a bug of some description, he's your man. Dr. Gillian Tenney is a GP vet and practice owner from Mount Isa in Australia, who keeps finding unusual infections in her patients and helping us to learn more about them. Dr. Gillian has an honors in parasitology and has diagnosed over 300 cases of Spyro Circa loopy in her clinic. She's also involved in a research project about this with the University of Queensland. So she is the boots on the ground for us, and she shares her wide experiences with this condition with us. Please enjoy Professor Peter Irwin and Dr. Gillian Tenney and Spyro Circa loopy. Welcome to the Vet Vault, and thank you so much for joining us. And we have Professor Peter Irwin, the tick and other bug man. We've had him before talking about ehrlichiosis, the vector-borne diseases professional. And we're going to talk about it, a newbie to a lot of people, not that new to me because of my South African background, but new to most of us, Spyro Circa loopy. Now, firstly, quick introduction, Gillian, just so listeners know, and so I get an idea where you are from. And well, you're in Mount Isa. A lot of people don't know where Mount Isa is in Australia. So vaguely, roughly speaking, just so people can go, how far away is this stuff happening from where I live? where in Australia is Mount Isa?
In northwest Queensland, inland from Townsville, but closer to the Northern Territory. So
okay, so quite far in, yeah. Inland. So far.
Long way to walk.
Yeah. Long way to walk, okay. Long way to walk for a tick that's infected with some weird sort of parasite. So, Gillian, I had no idea that Spyro Circa was a thing in Australia. I went to uni in South Africa and we had Spyro Circa there relatively commonly. And I can remember very little about the details. I remember something about a growth in the thorax somewhere, and then they get weird things on their legs if they have it really badly. That's about the gist of my knowledge, but I had no idea that it was in Australia. Tell me what you're seeing in Mount Isa. You've picked it up in a few cases. How many cases? Give us a bit of a rundown of what's happening where you are.
Well, I have to credit Dr. Len Fulham for he was the first person to diagnose it in Mount Isa. And he said he diagnosed it first in the mid-90s. So he picked it up in a pigging dog. So the owner was bringing dung beetles into his yard, collecting them, I think, to help with getting rid of the stools. And a few of his dogs were sick and died. So Len decided to do a post-mortem to find out what was going on. And that's when he first diagnosed Spyro Circa. He had heard of it and read about it a few cases. I think in the Northern Territory, it was still, I think, quite rare. And since then, it's been on our radar. And I started in 2014 and we would see maybe 3-4 cases every year of dogs with clinical signs. And then I had one dog that developed neurological signs, is really sick and and died. And then since then, I decided to just endoscope dogs coming in to the clinic with the owner's permission for just routine surgeries, and I found there are a lot more cases that are just, most cases actually I think are asymptomatic, or the signs are mild and not something that the owner thought was abnormal, say just occasional vomiting.
So how many cases are we talking in a how long a period? How many cases have you diagnosed, clinical or subclinical?
Well, I've lost count because we've been a bit busy, and I need to get onto that again, but it would be over 300 cases that we've seen in Mount Isa.
Whoa. Okay, wow. So, Peter, what's the official stats? Is Mount Isa the home of Spider Seca, or is it just that Mount Isa has a vet that's looking for it?
Well, I think Mount Isa is probably the epicenter of Spira Circa in Australia. Just to sort of go back with a little bit of my background too, I saw a case in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002, something like that, at Murdoch over in Perth. And that case had come from Mount Isa. So, you know, it's been in Mount Isa for a while. But it's not the only place in northern Australia that the parasite exists. The very first report, I believe, of Spira Circa in Australia was in northern New South Wales. And then cases have been reported in other parts of Queensland, Bamaga, right up at the top of Cape York, and across over in Kununurra, Western Australia. It's certainly, you know, Mount Isa, cases have been diagnosed for quite a long time in Mount Isa. And as Julian says, it's really common. And the work that Julian is doing in raising awareness and finding these cases is extraordinary. It's fantastic.
Okay. So give us the idiot's guide to Spira Circa, Peter. What is it? What spreads it? How do our patients get it? Yeah, give us, start at the very beginning.
Well, I'll give you the idiot's guide, and then Gillian can fill in the gaps.
Okay, okay, cool.
So it's a nematode parasite. It's a worm, roundworm, that is associated with dung beetles. And it affects not only domestic dogs, but actually some wild canids as well. The dog becomes infected when it eats either the dung beetle or, more commonly, a paratenic host. And just to sort of remind everybody about their parasitology, paratenic host is another animal which has eaten a dung beetle. So things like chooks, for example, or rodents or reptiles, lizards and things that might have eaten a dung beetle. The parasite, the infective larvae that were in the dung beetle, then gets into those paratenic hosts. But it doesn't go any further in them.
Okay.
So dogs can become infected from eating, as I say, either the beetle or any of those other organisms.
Yeah, so rat eats dung beetle, dog eats rat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
Or chook or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting to know whether Gillian has any observations on this. Well, we could ask her, shall we now?
So what are you finding? Are you getting a feeling for how it is getting into your patients up that way?
Oh, the eating tartar lizards. So that would be the main. We have a lot of lizards here. So I suspect that's one of the first things we ask. And, look, most often dogs that have an infection, lizard eaters, the tartar lizards. I have also diagnosed it in Labradors that like to eat their own stool. So that's another. So they must be just eating the dung beetle straight. But I think it's mostly eating lizards or sometimes birds, I think, from when I've spoken to clients.
Okay. So it'll be I'm expecting that you're seeing it more in your hunting kind of dogs, your terriers and the things that go out and see, well, that's moving, I'm going to eat it, sort of a dog. I don't picture my chilled poodle cross who won't eat anything if it's not cooked chicken actually getting Spira Circa.
I have definitely seen it in little, that I always thought that, we mostly see it in terriers, but I have also seen it in massive Great Danes, bull mastiffs that you think would be too slow to even catch a lizard. But we do surprisingly see it in little fluffy poodles and things too. But most commonly, in terriers, Staffordshire Bull terriers, the ones that like to chase.
So, Peter, back to you then. So, dog eats infected organism, and then what happens? What's the life cycle in the dog?
Yep. So then it gets really interesting, and the larvae get into the gastric mucosa, into the stomach mucosa, And then they migrate up the gastric arteries, up the walls of the gastric arteries to the aorta. And their first goal, if you like, is to get to the aorta. And they do this, as I say, by migrating through the walls of the vessels to the aorta, where they settle in for a little while, for a few months. So it takes them, various studies suggest different amounts of time, but a relatively short time to get to the aorta, maybe a couple of weeks, something like that.
So going upstream?
Up, yeah, well, they're in the wall of the vessel, so they're not fighting against the flow. Gotcha. But once they're in the aorta, adjacent to the esophagus, they sit there for a while. They do quite a bit of damage to the aorta, and we'll come back to that later. And once they've been there a month or two, they then migrate on into the esophagus, which is adjacent, of course, within the mediastinum. Once they're in the esophagus, they complete their life stage. The males and the females have developed by then. And the males and females do what males and females do, and then the females will produce eggs. And they create nodules within the esophagus with a hole in it, and the female worms can be seen. I think Jillian has seen the female worms sort of sticking their posterior out through the hole, and they lay their eggs into the lumen of the esophagus. So then they're swallowed by the dog. They make their way right the way through the intestine of the dog and out in the feces as embryonated eggs. So the female worms lay these embryonated eggs and out they go. And then the life cycle is completed from the feces. The dung beetles, of course, you know, will go for all sorts of poo, and they then get infected when they eat, ingest the embryonated eggs there.
So they're spending their time either in the blood vessel walls, and then they move across, and then they go live in the esophageal wall as well. So they're not luminal; they're sitting in the connective tissue of the wall. Basically.
Yes, that's right.
Okay,
that's right. And I guess the pathology, which we'll talk about in a minute, but the clinical signs of the pathology is all associated with either the migratory stages, because sometimes, like other parasites, there can be aberrant migration, and the larvae can go to all sorts of places that they don't intend to go, and lead to clinical signs, be it neurological or whatever.
Okay.
Or the sort of second group of clinical signs mainly are associated with the esophageal lesions.
Okay, wow. So, Jillian, beyond when you scope dogs to go looking, so you're obviously scoping the esophagus, and then you go, oh, I can see nodules and I can see worm butts poking out into the intestinal tract. What are you seeing them come in like clinically? What are we looking out for?
So the main presentation is trouble swallowing, inappetence, and or regurgitating, vomiting, sometimes coughing. So they're the main things we see. Other signs, and like Peter said, our neurological signs. I've had a few dogs with neurological signs, hypersalivation, really drooling. Not all dogs have that though. And then some cases dogs will have paresis in their hind legs, or sometimes a front leg. And then other times I've had dogs just die on presentation from an aortic aneurysm. So that's, okay. They've had no signs whatsoever, and they've come in and died not long after being in the clinic. And then we've found that they've had a bleed, and then when we've done the postmortem, found the nodules in their esophagus. Yeah, most of the time it's the difficulty swallowing, regurgitating. They're the main signs we see.
Okay, so you've got a mass effect of some sort. Is it a physical mass effect, or is it a stricture of the esophagus, or what's the pathology that you start seeing in the esophagus when you scope them, Jillian? Is it physically just a big nodule full of worms?
Yeah, it's mostly a mass effect in the esophagus, but sometimes they will only have a small nodule, but they'll have quite marked clinical signs. They must just cause a bit of esophagitis as well. But I think the nodules can become infected. Is that right, Peter?
Yep, that's right, Jane. They're quite often surrounded by pus. And I don't know if you've done any postmortems on these, or maybe when you cut into them or whatever, you know, you get this pus comes out of them. So, you know, histologically, they're a sort of pus-filled nodule as well, with lots of lymphocytes, lots of neutrophils Yes. So antibiotics might actually play a bit of a role in managing some of that local infection.
Oh, and the neurosigns that you talked about, so hind limb or spinal or anything, again, that's aberrant larval migration where instead of going along the vessel wall, it gets to the spinal cord, or yeah, so they can go anywhere.
Yep, that's right. So they get into the spine, as you say, into the spinal cord, they cause hemorrhage, and then this is a sort of cervicothoracic myelopathy. So I guess they look like a disc, you know, some other transsectional type lesion in the thoracic, usually in the thoracic spinal cord. Yeah, so off their hind legs, front legs may be fine. I guess upper motor neuron type signs to the hind limbs, but anyway, paresis and paralysis, as Gillian says. The other thing that is perhaps useful diagnostically, and I'd be interested to know what Gillian's experience with this is, but some of those larvae that are migrating on their way to the spine cause a periosteal reaction around the thoracic vertebrae, mid-thoracic to caudal thoracic vertebrae. And you see those as exostoses on the bones. And, you know, it's not a specific diagnosis, but again, in a dog, we'll come to diagnosis in a minute and how difficult it can be sometimes. But that's something that is well reported in the literature. I've not actually seen that in any of the relatively few cases I've treated here in Australia. But Gillian, is that something that you recognize if you take thoracic radiographs?
Yeah, I definitely see. Sometimes you can see the esophageal nodule in the x-ray, but often you don't. But I, on the x-ray, I was finding a pattern with the ventral spondylitis. So you could see those changes on the caudal thoracic vertebrae. One of the young dogs, I had a 9-month-old Labrador. She had neurological signs, was really terrible vocalizing. We thought she had steroid responsive meningitis, arteritis for ages because she was responding to steroids, but we found that she had spirocerca. Unfortunately, she died. And then when we did it, I did a post-mortem, you could see all those changes on the vertebrae, but also coming down onto the ribs, I think, as well. I've never seen it before.
I remember back from South Africa, you'd get this weird thing. It's called Marie's disease or something,
yes.
where they get distal limb bony changes to do with the intrathoracic mass. Yeah, well, that's all I remember. What's the go with that? What causes it, and what does it look like clinically?
Well, yeah, that's what you're describing is hypertrophic osteopathy, which is Marie's disease, as you correctly remember from your undergraduate days. And yeah, that's, as you said, it's when there's a periosteal proliferation in the distal limbs, particularly the carpus, the carpal bones, the metacarpals, distal radius ulna, and also to some extent in the hind legs, get a lot of periosteal reaction and lameness. So it's
painful.
It's painful.
Yeah.
And so lameness is a sign of that. And it's associated with these lesions in the esophagus. And what we haven't talked about yet is the preponderance of these nodules to become cancerous. I'll talk about that in a minute. But I understand that they will occur with just the nodules, but certainly also when it's turned neoplastic.
Yeah, okay, right.
Gillian, do you see lame dogs as well?
I haven't seen any dogs with that hypertrophic osteopathy or the Marie's disease, but we do see a lot of dogs with bone cancers, but I'm not sure if that is, are you saying that the cancer, bone cancers and other cancers may be linked to the spirocerca? Sorry, is that what you?
No, sorry for any confusion. No, the nodules in the esophagus, about a quarter of them, at least according to the literature, about a quarter of dogs with nodules in the esophagus become cancerous. So they turn into sarcomas, and a number of different types of sarcoma have been reported. But it's just the presence of the lesion within the thoracic cavity that leads through mechanisms, I think, that are probably not terribly well understood, to these periosteal proliferations in the distal limbs. So, you know, this, you can see hypertrophic osteopathy in animals with lung cancer as well, you know, quite unrelated to spirocerca.
I haven't really seen those bony changes in the limbs. I have seen a couple of, like you said, the cancers in the esophagus.
So these are all very frightening things that I feel like people are listening going, oh shit, that's something I've got to keep an ear out for. But let's talk about dung beetles first. Do we have endemic dung beetles in Australia? And if so, where do we get them? Basically, do I have to worry about them where we live, Peter?
There's a wonderful story behind this. There are native dung beetles in Australia, but the native dung beetles evolved here to push away macropod, you know, marsupial poo. They're marsupial poo pushers.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple of 100 years ago, cattle and horses arrived. And then the native dung beetles are not capable of dealing with introduced species poo. So in the 1960s, and it's as recently as this, the 1960s, there was something called the Australian Dung Beetle Project.
Mm-hmm.
And this involved the importation, the bringing in of a whole range of species of dung beetle, actually 43 different species of dung beetle. I can hardly believe that, but anyway, different species, and liberally sort of plastering them all over the Australian landscape. Not so much to deal with the aesthetics of lots of poo in the fields, because apparently, you know, if you go back and you read about how things were, you know, poo would pile up in paddocks,
yeah,
and that wouldn't be very nice. But it was the associated fly problem that really worried people. So CSIRO oversaw the importation of all these dung beetles. Prior to that, there had never been a case of Sparocerca lupi. But within a few years of all this happening, the first case was diagnosed. So I guess to answer your question, all the dung beetles were brought in. And I guess it's assumed that some of those dung beetles, probably from South Africa and other places, you know, brought with them Sparocerca lupi.
So you brought the South Africans in to come and clean up all the shit, but then they came with their own problem. Wow, okay. So are they widely distributed throughout the country, or is it regional, climatic, or?
Well, I understand now there are dung beetles everywhere in Australia. In terms of cases of Sparocerca, as we said earlier on, most of the cases have been reported from the northern parts of Australia, so tropics and subtropics.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, as listeners will appreciate from the discussion that we're having, this could be a really challenging diagnosis.
Mm.
Whereas there may be some very specific aspects to it, like if you put a scope down and you see nodules,
yeah,
you know, there are not many things that cause nodules in the esophagus. But I would imagine there are cases of sparocercosis happening around the country that may go unrecognized.
Yeah, sudden death.
Sudden death.
Weird things.
Bleeding out like this, you know, the odd lame dog.
Yeah.
And then, you know, regurgitating and vomiting dogs. They're always a bit challenging, aren't they, in practice? And they might be put down to an idiopathic megaesophagus, you know, something like that, especially if they're not scoped.
So yeah.
I'd be really interested to hear your perspective on this too, Gillian, just the sort of the challenge of diagnosis. I mean, we could talk about some specific tests in a moment.
Before Gillian tells us more about diagnosis, treatment, and importantly, prevention of Sparocerca, just a quick plug for our clinical podcast series. If you like this form of learning, me asking the dumb questions that you probably also have of very smart people in a format that you can consume while you do other things to help you stay up to date so that you can be a better clinician, and also just because it feels nice to know your stuff. Work is more fun when you don't feel like a permanent imposter. You should sign up for our clinical podcasts at vvn.supercast.com. Each episode is also backed by our beautiful show notes. Have a look at the notes for this episode at thevetfile.com to get an idea of what they look like. They have become pretty much my number one resource at work because they're up to date, they're concise, and they cover stuff that I've already listened to on here. So the knowledge is somewhere in here in my head. I just need to unearth it again. That's vvn.supercast.com. Your first 2 weeks are free. Okay, back to Dr. Gillian.
Yeah, so I think they came. I had one dog that I thought had a massive tumor in its lungs, and it turned out to be Sparocerca. I've had dogs that have thought, oh, it's definitely Sparocerca, and the dog's had a foreign body, or vice versa. It's just really, yeah, hard because there are so many different signs, and dogs can present differently. It can be challenging to diagnose.
So let's talk about specifics. It sounds like it's got to be on your radar because we're going to confuse it for a bunch of things. It's going to look like something else. And if it's not on your radar at all, you might just miss it as a diagnosis. Does that sound fair?
Yeah. So GI signs, well, upper GI, you know, esophageal signs, and some of the cases I've seen, vomit as well. You know how we're always taught to differentiate regurgitation from vomiting.
Mm.
But I have seen dogs that really seem to be doing a bit of both with this. So,
yep.
And then there's this hypersalivation and this weird salivary gland enlargement that is quite well reported. Julian probably sees some of those cases as well, you know, with profuse salivation and discomfort on swallowing. So, you know, here's a picture of a dog with esophageal disease.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But in addition to that, then it has to be on a differential diagnosis list for, as you said, sudden death, you know, bleeding into the chest. Main differential would be rodenticide toxicity or something like that. Lamenesses, and then these neuro signs. So dogs with paresis, hind limb paresis, or paraparesis, and or paraplegia.
Okay.
Would you agree with that as a summary?
Yes, definitely. I've had dogs that a dog went to a specialist because it was paralyzed in its back leg and it was put down to a blood clot from its heart. And then it wasn't until I think a couple of months later it came back. It was vomiting and just scraped that dog and it had spirocerca. And that, yeah, so it was probably maybe a blood clot from, I'm not sure if the parasite can cause blood clots, but once we started treating the spirocercosis, the dog improved. Like you said, it can cause such a wide variety of clinical signs and lots of different presentations.
So do we have an easy test, like a PCR or an ELISA or something, or do you have to literally scope them to go see the nodules there?
No simple test. I'll start off and then you can set the record straight. So I guess there are probably three main modalities for diagnosis. One is imaging the thorax. Uh-huh. We've talked a little bit about the fact that you might see radio opacity suggesting a lesion in the esophagus, but you know, sometimes it's difficult to differentiate that from a lung lesion. We talked about the spondylosis on the thoracic vertebrae. So there may be some clues from a thoracic radiographs or CT, if you have a CT in the back room. Then there's the fecal testing. Remember, these female parasites, female worms are spitting out eggs, embryonated eggs. The good thing about this is that the eggs are very distinctive. I don't think there's really any other parasite eggs that look like them. They're sort of, I think they describe them as being bullet-shaped, and you can see the little larva inside them, the embryonated larva inside them. So that's the good thing. The bad thing is, of course, the females don't shed the eggs all the time, and so it's intermittent. And so any given fecal exam on any given day might not reveal them. So that's the second thing. And then probably the best diagnostic test is what Jillian's doing, and that's to scope them. But of course, in the real world, unless you happen to be in Mount Isa and have an interest, you know, you're not going to be scoping your patients. But in terms of, you know, a visual hit and a diagnosis, endoscopy is the way to go. We might talk about the heartworm test in a minute, Jillian, if you like. But
yes.
Do you want to have any further comments on what I've just said?
No, I just found it easier to endoscope them. But like you said, I found it hard in the past to diagnose cases on a fecal float. I think you need a special medium. And also, like you said, they're not shedding all of the time. It's much easier for us to diagnose them by endoscope.
Okay. So if you think it's spirocerca, you're scoping them. How about the aberrant one? So let's say I've got a Nero's case and now I've got another parasite. I've got to rule it out for my GME case or my steroid responsive. Would it ever be a case where it's not actually in the esophagus yet? So it's gone up the blood vessels and now it's in the nervous system somewhere, but it's not going to be there to see when I scope it.
What do you think about that, Julian? I mean, theoretically, of course, those larvae can be causing spinal cord lesions before other larvae have got to the esophagus. I get the impression from reading and talking to people with these cases is that usually there are already some esophageal nodules when some of these other things occur.
Okay.
And certainly, you know, the cancerous type changes, they occur later. I think dogs with acute aortic aneurysm and bleed to death, you know, they might not have any nodules. But
yeah.
be interested to hear what Gillian says in terms of chronology.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that either. The dogs that have had neurological signs that I've endoscoped that I suspected was Virusoka have had nodules, and they've been quite large nodules, so it's been clear cut, but I guess it's okay. Possible. But I should say that also I've found far more dogs have no signs whatsoever. So we have found most of their cases, the dogs are asymptomatic too. So they don't really have signs. We're picking them up just when they are having routine surgeries at the clinic, just with the owner's permission, we're endoscoping cases. So some dogs will have massive nodules and no signs at all.
Wow.
So that's a reflection of your unique situation there, isn't it, really, Gillian? I mean, it's very instructive, but, you know, one assumes that all those dogs that are asymptomatic when you're perhaps spaying them or something in a year or two or whatever might go on to develop signs? Or do you think there really is there are a lot of subclinical cases that never do advance to all this exciting pathology we're talking about?
I think a lot of dogs don't progress. That's just my opinion. A lot of clients do like us to do the routine screening. So we do them at 6 months or whenever they're de-sexed. And I've had quite a few cases that have been negative on that scan, and then they've come back a year later unwell, and we've scoped them and they've got the clear nodule. So there's certainly dogs that are unwell. But a lot of the cases that I've seen are older dogs, and the nodules, they've got quite a few nodules, and then some scarring where you can see there was a nodule, but that's cleared up, and then a new nodule's formed somewhere else and they haven't shown signs. Whether or not it's the owners that have not noticed, I don't think they all progress to have some of the severe signs that I've seen in other cases. So,
am I right in saying that you're also involved in a research project on this? Is that one of the other reasons why you would scope them again later when they're asymptomatic?
Oh, yes, sorry. So we are... because I had a spate of dogs a couple of years ago. We might have had 5 or 6 dogs just die within a short period of each other, and they were all diagnosed to have Spirocerca, and it had me a bit worried. And then I contacted the University of Queensland. So we are doing a study with them, and I think the plan is to send blood away so that hopefully a blood test may be able to be developed that will help in the diagnosis. So that would, I guess, that would be good for those cases if there is an esophageal nodule present, but the immature stage is causing a problem, then that would be picked up that way. Or if the dog's too unwell to be endoscoped or anaesthetized.
I'm trying to figure out what to take away from this as a clinician, because I've never seen it in Australia, but maybe I've missed it. I'm not going to be scoping. Is it regional? Is it because there's obviously a hotspot there, like working in Brisbane or in Perth or something like that? You're not going to start scoping looking for a disease that you've never really seen before.
I think you should, actually.
You reckon?
I think that's the way to pick them up. But I'm speaking with a sort of research.
Yeah.
You know, not a very practical, you know.
The one that worries me most almost, because I go, yeah, if you come to me with upper GI signs, I'm going to x-ray you, and there's a next step, we'll probably scope you. So you're going to find it if it's the main presenting thing. The Neuros one freaks me out, because you go, all right, let's send off the PCR and our ELISA for Neo and Toxo and we do all of that. Would you see parasites on a CSF tap if you're tapping them, or not necessarily?
No, I think you wouldn't see the parasites, but you'd see inflammation. So these dogs have inflammatory spinal disease.
And then you go, yeah, it's got a GME.
It's generally eosinophilic.
Ah.
So, you know, over here on the east coast of Australia, you know, we always think of angiostrongylus as the cause of eosinophilic meningitis or meningoencephalomyelitis. But this is another differential. It's eosinophilic. It's a parasite.
So that's the next question then. So that's diagnosing the sick one in terms of preventing it. So if it's a worm, do your standard anti-helminthics kill it before it starts migrating to all of these nasty places?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll start off that answer, and maybe Gillian can follow. So most routine anti-wormers really have very limited efficacy at preventing this. The drug that has been shown to be most efficacious is an ivermectin, so moxidectin. And the drug or the preparation that is actually now registered in Australia to prevent Sparacerca lupi is Advocate.
Okay.
So they previously Bayer, the Elanco product. And the early work was done in South Africa and in Europe, but South Africa and Reunion Island, of all places. And then more recently, it's got a registration claim to prevent Sparacerca. So dogs or pups put onto Advocate from a young age, it's very, very efficacious at preventing it. And has much better activity than something like milbemycin, for example.
Okay. Gillian, what are you guys recommending to your clients? Do you get tick paralysis there? You get paralysis tick in Mount Isa?
No, we don't have paralysis ticks out here, which is excellent, which is thankfully. But yes, we recommend Advocate for prevention. And we haven't seen as many cases recently. And I think it is all down to using Advocate now, because that's what we recommend when puppies come in for their vaccinations. So they start off on that. But for dogs that also do have the esophageal nodules, we use Advocate as treatment. So we use the Advocate as a puppy to prevent the parasite, but then the treatment also is Advocate once a week for 12 weeks. And then we repeat the endoscope at 12 weeks. And if the nodule has resolved, then they go on to the monthly prevention. We did use ivermectin in the past, but it was a bit difficult for owners. So we used it, we prescribed it orally, but it was harder for owners to use. And yeah, we recommend the Advocate. So that's a lot easier for clients to use as well, and safer, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I guess strictly, I mean, all of this is off label, but as you say, there's a lot of data to support Advocate in that way, once a week for 12 weeks, spot on. So, the monthly dose every week for 12 weeks.
To treat, okay.
To treat. This is for treatment.
Yeah.
We used to use ivermectin, but there are risks associated with that as well, of course. And then doramectin, which is Dectomax, isn't it? Doramectin has been used. It's a large animal product. Mm-hmm. And some of the papers that have been published would suggest that doramectin in advanced cases, or cases with significant esophageal disease, the doramectin may be better than Advocate, but in general, the recommendation is Advocate. And then, Gillian, do you, if the lesions are still there, do you just keep going with the Advocate?
Yeah, I've had a few cases where I've had to continue a little bit longer, maybe another month or two. Sometimes it can be a bit tricky because they look resolved, but then there is some scar tissue and it's hard to really tell. But generally, most cases you do see a significant improvement within the 12 weeks and the nodule has cleared up. There may be just a bit of I don't know if it's scar tissue from the operculum, but generally, yes, 12 weeks is all they usually require.
Do you add anything else into this treatment plan? I mean, do you use an antimicrobial in any way? This is a leading question, but I just wondered if you do.
I do, yes. So for dogs that show clinical signs, and sometimes there's quite a lot of bleeding from the nodule, so I'll often put them on amoxicillin, clavulanic acid. And then I also find a lot of the dogs are really unwell, don't want to eat, they're gagging, they're really uncomfortable. So sometimes I also put them on prednisolone as well. And I find that they respond quite quickly to steroids, and I think must help reduce the inflammation in their esophagus. Yeah. And sometimes I'll put them on Carafate as well. These are the dogs that are really unwell, and sometimes I need to be in hospital for a few days and not eating. But yes, I do use an antimicrobial and steroids often in symptomatic cases.
Yeah. Hugh might choose to cut this bit out, but just two other comments. First of all, just interestingly, the Sparacerca lupi worm, they've now shown there's a symbiont bacterium associated with it. You know the whole story with heartworm, of course, and treating with doxycycline as part of the heartworm treatment protocol. And the doxycycline kills the symbiont, which further weakens and kills the heartworm. Well, as I say, this particular bacterium, it's not Wolbachia, it's a different bacterium that is associated with Spirocerca. And I'm looking out for studies, or hoping somebody is going to look into this as to whether Advocate with an antibiotic perhaps might be even more effective.
Why would I cut that out?
Well, I don't know.
Responsible antibiotic use.
Well, possibly. But the other thing was this weird thing about the salivary gland abnormalities and being phenobarbital responsive. And I have used phenobarbital in some of these cases in the past to try and control the excess salivation and the discomfort and all that type of thing. And I wondered if you'd been down that tricky pathway as well or not, Julian.
I haven't, but I do recall the previous owner of the clinic, Len. I remember him using phenobarbital for treating hypersalivation as well. I haven't used it myself, though. I don't see that many cases of dogs with salivary gland pathology, but every now and again we do see some.
Yeah, I think that in its own right can be very distressing for the dog and very distressing for the owners. And so it is something to consider. And there's published literature about its efficacy, which varies greatly from dog to dog. But nevertheless, it's something to have in the armory.
So there's nothing like with heartworm where you have to be careful how fast you kill the parasite, or thing that, you know, where they suddenly going to shed into the aorta and cause a thrombus or something. You just kill the buggers, get rid of them.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Nice.
Just perhaps while we're talking about heartworm, this is another just important thing about Spirocerca, and that is the cross-reactivity in the heartworm antigen tests of Spirocerca. So in the studies that have been done, up to a quarter of heartworm-positive cases had Spirocerca and not heartworm. So if you live in a heartworm endemic area and you routinely are using heartworm antigen test, then this is just something else to bear in mind. And Gillian, I'd be very interested to know if you have a take on this from your perspective.
Yeah, I definitely have seen cases, but it's hard because we also do see heartworm here as well. But when we do get a positive heartworm, like an antigen test, we always look for the microfilary as well, just to be sure. And then if that's negative, then I do recommend endoscoping them. But it also becomes challenging when a dog has both heartworm and Spirocerca in terms of treatment.
Jeez. I'm still a bit stuck with the prevention strategy if you are in a paralysis tick area in Australia, because then you want to be on an isoxazoline or something tick specific, but that's not going to do anything for your Spirocerca. I basically just concerned about my dog.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, some of the isoxazolines also have novamycin in them, for example, but novamycin's not a particularly good preventative for Spirocerca, so okay. You'd need to use the two, I think.
So if we start seeing those sort of cases, then you've got to have both, or go region dependent. Go, yeah, which is my biggest risk, the tick or the Spirocerca. Okay, that's fascinating and a little bit scary, interesting, but good to know about. Are we missing anything, Peter? Have I missed anything important in my ignorance?
Well, we seem to have covered a lot of ground. No, I think from my perspective, we've talked about all the important clinical, diagnostic, and sort of preventative therapeutic aspects.
Yeah. Julian, am I missing anything?
No, I don't think so. I think Peter did a very good job of explaining everything.
You'd bloody hope so.
that's what you pay me for.
Julian, thank you so much for making the time and for your ongoing curiosity and finding these cool things and being happy to share with us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Before you disappear, I wanted to tell you about our new weekly newsletter. I speak to so many interesting people and learn so many new things while making the podcast. So I thought I'd create a little summary each week of the stuff that stood out for me. We call it the Vet Vault 321, and it consists of, firstly, three clinical pearls. These are three things that I've taken away from the clinical podcast episodes. My light bulb moments, the penny dropping, any new facts, and the stuff that we need to know to make all the other pieces fit. Then, two other things. These could be quotes, links, movies, books, a podcast highlight, anything that I've come across outside of clinical vetting that I think you might find interesting. And then one thing to think about. I'll share something that I'm pondering, usually based on something that I've read or heard, but sometimes it'll be just my own musings or rants. The goal of this format is that you can spend just 2 to 3 minutes on the clinical stuff and move right along if that's all that you're after. But if you're looking for content that is more nourishing than cat videos or doom scrolling, then our two other things should send you in the right direction. And then something extra for when you feel like a slightly longer read. If you'd like to get these in your inbox each week, then subscribe by following the newsletter link in the show description wherever you're listening to this. It's free, I think it's useful, it's fun, and it's easy to unsubscribe if it's not for you. Okay, we'll see you next time.